it. Just give me a sense of how you got into baking bread.
Well, I did not grow up in a family where this was the norm by any means. But when I was in my early 20s, I worked at a backcountry ranger station in northwest Montana doing trail work for a bit. And it was a really big part of the culture there and the norm there among families and friends that I was meeting. And one of my good friends, Erica, was just so like on top of it that the first thing she did when she got off of her hitch was we'd get to the cabin and she'd be busting out her starter, feeding it, and making some bread without any recipe present in front of her. And I was like, oh, I want to do that. So I asked her to teach me, and that's how I got started.
Yeah, why do you think that was something that those folks did? Why was that a priority for them?
The self-sufficiency piece of it, I know, was pretty huge, especially in the community that I was getting to know there. A lot of people were hunters and fishermen, and just took a lot of pride in being able to like make their own, do their own things. And in the backcountry setting, like a lot of the food we were getting was just not that fresh. Similar to being in Wrangell, you're getting stuff that's been shipped from super far away, and there's really just nothing quite like fresh bread. And that was really like, other than going to a bakery, that was the first time I was experiencing it in a home setting. And I was just so immediately enamored that I couldn't help but want to know how to do it for myself.
Angie,
Yeah.
how about you?
I had my first real sourdough bread experience, also probably early 20s. I was a college kid. And I went to my local crunchy hippie food co-op in Kalamazoo, where I went to school. And I had this like incredible, like little bakery was making these loaves of like crusty bread, like salty chunks on top. And it was so good. But I was also broke, so I could not afford to buy these loaves of bread. But once I had the first taste, like I needed it in my life. So I was like, I can learn how to do that. I'll figure it out. And I was also still learning how to make food in general. So it's like, let's be cooking hamburger helper every night for dinner and also learn to make like rustic sourdough bread. So my first few years,
nothing wrong with that.
yeah, I tried to make a starter following like instructions I found in a book or online somewhere. And it was a disgusting, like moldy, like covered bowl that I hid in a cupboard and forgot about. And then I opened it and it smelled like someone died in the kitchen. Like it was a total failure. And the first few like loaves of bread that I baked were bricks that you could have broken a window with. So it took a long time to figure it out, but I was determined. And then, you know, you get in that vein where you're like, I'm going to learn how to do this thing. Like I have to learn it, even though it's going to take me 5 years. So that was what drew me in. And I just love bread. So I needed it. And I had to have access to that very specific kind. So, yeah. And then it was years and years of trial and error and trying to figure it all out from there. But especially, like Holly said, living up here, like there's not really a baker in town. So that's where I've really dug into like wanting to perfect and figure it out because you got to have the fresh bread.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're saying that need is why you stuck through it, even despite all the challenges and
Like really bad loaves.
Yeah.
Really bad.
Bad loaves.
Forgetting salt. That's
Yeah.
never fun.
Yeah. And it just takes a while, especially if you're doing sourdough where it's a sort of unique type of leavening where you're like, instead of buying yeast at the store, you're essentially capturing it from the air and using like your local bacteria that just exists, which is super cool. But it takes a little bit to like figure that out and, you know, like what it like. It's a living creature. So you got to kind of learn like what makes it happy and what's going to make it thrive. And so that's where you get a lot of bricks and pancake loaves and like weird things.
Yeah, so just talk more about sourdough.
Yeah.
Well, there's just a lot of patience. Whether you're an old pro or you're a beginner, learning how to be patient with the fact that today the humidity is 85% in my home, and yesterday it was 65%, and that's going to have an impact on the activity of my starter, how much lactic acid buildup I get, how sour the bread is versus mild, like. Everything plays into it. The humidity, the temperature, the consistency that you're feeding it, how often you're using it. So it's just like, even when you think that you've gotten it figured out, sometimes you won't even necessarily notice that the environment in your kitchen has changed, like, just enough to change how well that loaf rises.
Yeah.
Or you try a different flour and you're like, why does this one not work nearly as well as that other one? And maybe they're just different brands and they have a different protein content.
Okay. Yeah.
And I really, at its core, I mean, obviously sourdough has a really unique and interesting culture in Alaska. And what makes it so cool, I mean, essentially sourdough or sourdough bread uses this, like, do-it-yourself leaven. Like I mentioned before, you're not necessarily getting yeast from the store, you're creating your own. And so you can make your own starter super easy at home. It's really just a ratio of flour and water and time. And so you kind of let it sit, you let it culture. That mixture captures, like, yeast and bacteria that just exist in your air. So something that's cool about sourdough is that it's never the same twice or in any, like, the sourdough starter at my house is different than Holly's. And it's all, like, unique to your area, which is really cool. But you can keep it alive. It can go dormant. You can freeze your starter and then bring it back to life. You can just, you know, like, feed it fresh water and flour and kind of get it going again. So it's this really cool living creature. So that's why, like, you know, up in northern Alaska, you could travel with, like, your little sourdough pot and you could bring it back to life. And it was going to keep, as long as you had flour and water, you could have fresh bread. So it's a pretty cool way to, like, capture local flavor and kind of make it what you want. And once you've kind of mastered, like, how your starter likes to live, what makes it happy, and then what you like in your recipe, there's, like, endless combinations of things that you can do with it. So you can get creative with your sourdough bread. And I think what Holly's a science person, and she can speak, like, the science of, like, she was saying, lactic acid and proteins. And I'm like, I mix the flour and the water and then it feels like this. And I like the way this tastes. Like, I'm much more of a feeler. My brain doesn't wrap around those other components as well. So she might be able to speak to that more. But, you know, you can kind of let your starter age or let your bread ferment a little bit longer. And that changes the taste and the flavor, too. Yeah. So it's kind of a cool way to, like, get to know this little pet that you have bubbling on your countertop and all the things that you can make with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So when you... So you're going to make your starter just by adding water and flour and letting it sit in the conditions that you think are appropriate.
So, like, ideal conditions, countertop of your kitchen, you've got a glass, you want something that's non-reactive. So it can't be aluminum based. Aluminum is going to react and actually kill your yeast. So you want to make sure that it's stainless steel or, better yet, just plastic or glass, and just avoid metals because some things aren't labeled well. Quart mason jar is absolutely the easiest thing. And you just, like, you know, roughly equal parts water and flour, just a little bit, like, you know, half a cup and half a cup. And, like, mix that up in there. And then it can't be airtight. So you want to cover it so that, like, random big dust and whatnot aren't getting in. But yeast spores and bacteria are so tiny that you just cover the lid with, like, a kitchen towel, like, clean cheesecloth or, like, flour sack towel, paper towel, just something that's still porous. And that stuff will get in there. And you have to just be patient. Usually it takes, like, if you're starting from scratch, they say roughly anywhere from a few days to a week, depending on, like, your household and how much yeast and bacteria are naturally there. But you just check on it every day. Like, after the first 24 hours, often the best thing you can do is actually to, like, pour a little bit off and replace a little bit of the water and some fresh flour and just kind of, like, do that for the first 2 days, and then you're going to start to see some bubbles developing, and that means that it's captured something alive from the air, and those things are eating the sugars in the flour, and they're creating carbon dioxide waste. And
see, I told you, science. She's a bread scientist. But your starter, it likes warmth too. So, you know, you think of, like, what you learned in science class is that yeast and bacteria, they like moisture and warmth to thrive. So you can create those environments. Like, maybe your stove
Who's
is the warmest
not a scientist.
But I keep mine in, like, the warmest possible place in the kitchen so that it encourages it to, like, be lively and bubbly.
And then, like, you know, opposite of that, what Angie was talking about, but freezing it or putting it in the fridge to slow its activity if you're not going to use it for a while. And likewise, to develop flavor, you can play with temperature. The warmer it is when you've made your dough, and you're like, if you don't have a lot of time, like, I need bread today, this afternoon, 6 hours from now, because you definitely need more time than normal for non-sourdough breads, then it's gonna, you're gonna want it in that 70 to 80 degree kind of warmth. But if you've got some time on your hands, you can make your dough and put it in the fridge, and it'll do it like a cold fermentation. So it's just like low and slow. And you get some really complex flavors from that slow eating of the sugars. And it's just different. Yeah.
Yeah. Complex. How can you describe the different tastes?
Like a fine wine.
Yeah.
Notes of yeast.
Yeah, right.
I noticed just like a more, I like my bread to be more sour. Like, yeah, that's part of what I love about sour, like that like really tangy. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the longer ferment, you can get like a tangier, more sour bread.
Mm-hmm. And you just can't ferment it for as long and maintain the activity that you're going to need for it to still rise and have a good form if you do that at 80 degrees. So like if you're doing like a warm rise, it's not going to have the time to develop that sourness, but it's going to rise really fast. Yeah. And it'll bake and it'll be like very mild. Sometimes you won't even know, you're like, is this even sourdough?
Yeah, it kind of just tastes like a country white bread. Yeah. Or some, you know, like a basic white bread that's just, which isn't bad.
No, you don't, just depends just what you want
flavor. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, how long can you keep your sourdough?
The starter?
The starter.
Forever.
Forever. The one I was given was 140 years and going.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It had been in this one family. Like, this older couple that would come and caretake the cabin every fall, and they brought their starter with them, and she said that when they got married 30 years prior, it had been 110 years old when it was gifted to them. And she had kept it alive all that time, and she gave me some.
It's wild. Yeah, and so you're keeping it alive by using it and replenishing it.
Yeah,
basically. Yeah, and then again, you can let it go dormant by putting it in the fridge. Like, if I leave for 2 weeks, I just throw my starter in the fridge, and it gets a little funky. It develops what you can call hooch, layer of gross liquid on top, but you pour it out. I've even let my starter get so gross that there was, like, black fur growing on it.
And you scrape it off.
Scraped it off. I salvaged, like, a teaspoon of untouched stuff at the bottom and then fed it and brought it back to life.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like a... like, it maintains its own environment. Again, if you give it the right conditions, it'll kind of, like, come back to life. And
you can wash it.
Yeah.
Or, like, mine got really gross just recently, part of why I didn't have time to make bread for this event. I hadn't used it in a while, and I took it out of the fridge, and it was pretty gross. And I just, like, poured off almost all of it, added a bunch of water and some fresh flour, and made it really thin and let it sit for a bit, poured out most of it again, did the same thing. And you do that a few times, and that washes out the bad and gives it new life.
Yeah, the bacteria is so cool. Like, it regulates itself as long as, you know, you play into the couple things that it wants.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is the reason someone would want a 100-year-old sourdough starter?
It's just fun.
Because it's cool.
I mean, it's not like, it's just cool. It's just one of the, like, I don't have that starter anymore, sadly. My roommates baked it by accident in the oven when I left it there to warm up one day. It's like no single little yeast bacteria critter that's in there today is that old. It's just that the culture has been existing for that long. Mm-hmm. So it's many, many generations advanced.
Mm-hmm. I found with mine, so I wasn't given mine. The first one I created, actually, and I have no idea where I found this recipe or if I still have it, but again, I was seeking like really sour bread. And so I came across some recipe where you included like apples in the original ferment process, and that was supposed to give it like this extra sour flavor.
Yep.
That was probably like 10 years ago. So
pineapple juice is a common one too.
Yeah. But I found the longer, and it's probably just my own knowledge and experience working with the starter, but like it's a little more predictable. So now that I've had that starter for a few years, I kind of know what it needs and like how to bring it back to life and how far I can push it and But mm-hmm. I don't know, that that doesn't necessarily have to do with like the age of the starter, but just like how long have you been together? it's like a partnership.
Yeah, it definitely also makes a difference if you're maintaining like a white bread starter versus a rye starter, or other, like some people like to use sprouted grains, mm-hmm. and those will all behave a little bit differently from each other. Like a rye starter is particularly sour, and you can get like that really solid traditional rye flavor from, mm-hmm. Which is desirable for a lot of us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, I'm so glad we got to talk about sourdough right off the bat.
Yeah. It's the foundation.
Yeah. It's the foundation.
There's no bread without the leaven.
It's so Alaskan. I think we might be getting a call.
Maybe someone has a recipe to share?
Maybe. Yes.
That would be cool.
So let's go to a break real quick. And again, I remind you all, the number is 874-2345. All right, the time is 1:23, and we are talking about bread baking with Holly and Angie.
Hey.
So, Angie brought us some bread today.
Yeah, it was good. It inspired me to bake the weekly bread loaf yesterday.
It looks so good.
Yeah.
You do a weekly bread. Cool.
I try to. Yeah. I mean, since I've like gotten better at it and no longer bake bricks of bread, they're edible now. We rarely buy bread. I try to just make like a loaf a week, and that's my breakfast sandwich, toast, whatever.
We do a sandwich bread pretty much every other week. I make two at a time.
Yeah.
Right on. Mm-hmm.
How can you not? Yeah. Yes. So I did bring... this is just a classic sourdough bread, just like we talked about. The ingredients are only water, flour. There's a little, it's mostly white flour, a little bit of whole wheat flour, and salt. Cool. And that's it. Mm-hmm. Heat and love. So, and then I also brought some blueberry rhubarb jam because you got to get down with that too.
Yeah, because we live in Wrangell and it's amazing.
Yeah, we got a lot of jam access here. So, feel free. I'm going to pass it out. If you come up to the station and become a member today while we're on the air or pledge your support at kck.org, I will also give you a slice of bread. That's the only plug that I'll make.
Okay, cool.
Members only bread. Just kidding. Anyone can come try some.
So this is your perfected sourdough white bread.
Yes. And this, I can't take like full credit. I mean, I made the bread, but the recipe, a friend of mine recommended a really great book for especially baking sourdough bread. There's this bakery in San Francisco called Tartine, and they came out with a bread cookbook essentially. And so that's where this recipe comes from. They have two like base recipes that they do. One is solely sourdough. I think they call it their country loaf. And then they give you lots of spin-off options. Like once you kind of master that base, you know, you can add different kinds of flours. You could add olives or whatever like fancy things you want to. And then they have a second recipe where they do include a little bit of like traditional commercial yeast. You mix that with water. It's called a poulish, which is just fun to say. And then you blend that with your sourdough starter, and that makes it like this super huge puffy bread. So you could use that to make like a baguette. I made English muffins with that recipe recently. It was really good.
They were divine.
Holly tried those. They were tasty.
While camping, even better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fresh bread in the backcountry. Why not? This is a great, my starter has been well fed and happy this week. So this loaf turned out really spongy and soft and beautiful. I was stoked about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for bringing this in today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Try it
out. I'd say definitely one of the other unique things about sourdough that I love is just the greater tendency for that chewiness.
Yeah.
Like you can definitely achieve like a quasi sourdough with like a non-starter bread recipe if you do like the low and slow, like cool rising in your fridge. With your store-bought yeast, but the true sourdough, you just get such a nice chewiness. Mm-hmm.
So since we're talking about baking bread, we kind of talked about the foundation and where you start. A couple of fun things that I've learned in the baking process. If you're going for like a crusty artisan loaf, which is what we have here, where it's like a soft spongy inside and then that good like chewy crispy crust on the outside, what commercial bakers do is they have these like steam ovens, so they can steam the bread within the first like 20 minutes or so of baking, and then you take that steam away, that creates this like, it starts to rise and then it creates this like chewy outer crust. So we don't have commercial baking ovens. What I do is I have a cast iron, like a 5-quart Dutch oven, and I use that. So I pop it in my oven right when I turn it on to preheat so it gets hot with the oven, and then once the oven gets super hot, like ideally 500 degrees, mine doesn't get that high, so whatever, as hot as you can get it, I take that out and I drop my loaf in and then put the lid on, and then I bake that for 20 minutes and then I take the lid off and let it finish baking, and that gives it this like really luscious.
That is like the chewy way to get a home-baked artisan loaf.
You wouldn't know that it didn't come from the crunchy hippie co-op down the street or the fancy San Francisco bakery.
Where they have their giant wood fire. Ceramic.
Yeah. Fancy.
Fancy bread ovens.
Don't need it. You can do it in your own oven at home. And then conversely, like I've also done like the super easy, I have like a loaf pan and it has a lid on it that I'll use to let it rise. And then I bake it without the lid. It's shaped like a traditional bread loaf. It's still a delicious bread, but you don't get that like crispy outside. So that's more of like a soft sandwich bread where, you know, if you wanted just kind of a classic crust.
Yeah. And then, like, they're all the coatings. Like, some breads, you know, you'll do an egg wash if you want that shiny crust that's definitely a little bit thinner and flakier. It's not crusty crusty, but it's beautiful. And, you know, like, a classic challah bread, which is a lot of egg in the dough itself. It's like, I call it cotton candy bread. When you break it apart, it's just so beautiful and fluffy. And then it has a gorgeous egg wash crust on it. This is delicious, Angie. Thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me more, Holly. What can you say about this bread that you're eating?
I was going to ask you that.
I'll give you my take, too.
What can I say? It's got a beautiful airy crumb. There's some.
What does crumb mean?
The crumb. The crumb is the texture of the interior of the loaf. It's basically when you break it apart and you're looking at the body of the bread. The parts that come apart and make crumbs are the crumbs.
The parts that make crumbs.
But yeah, it's just airy, and just lots of like combination of tiny little holes, big holes. Like this was definitely a happy, active starter from which the bread came. And what you can see when you're not looking at your jam and butter side is that there's like barely any difference between the bottom of the loaf and the top of the loaf in the crumb structure, which shows that it was kind of like put in at the right time. Like if you put in a loaf too early sometimes, like if it hasn't risen to its full potential or whatever, then you might often get like a denser crumb at the base. Just gravity, it's just like but it's baking, and so the part that's on top is going to rise really fast, and it'll just be a really uneven spread of that texture. But this is really even, so good job.
Bread science. Thank you. I wondered if you'd notice that.
Yeah, this is spongy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is what's catching me most off guard, is that it's a spongy bread. Mm-hmm. It's not just airy.
Right.
It's much more moist and spongy.
It can hold its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the other thing, is like it doesn't just fall apart when you cut it. Mm-hmm. It actually holds its own. You can put all kinds of stuff on it.
Yeah.
And makes delicious sandwiches.
Breakfast sandwich. Fried egg, sprouts, mayonnaise, avocado, everything seasoning. Boom. I can say that from experience because that's what I ate for breakfast today. And it was great on this bread. Mm-hmm. So maybe Holly, I'm just going to poke in, but you make a lot of sourdough sweetbreads too. You have an incredible sticky bun. If anyone in town remembers when she was baking more and selling it at the Twisted Root Market, she would often make the Holly buns, little sticky bread buns. And those were so good.
That was a happy accident type of deal. I think most people who make their own bread, you'll find have like their favorite base recipe that they've discovered that works well for them. They remember it well. And then from that base, they play with it. And I can't remember exactly why, but I think I just like was feeling like trying something and I had some extra and I was like, oh, I wonder what this would be like in a cinnamon roll. And I didn't change the base. It was like my basic white bread sourdough recipe. And I just rolled it out and smothered it with some melted butter and threw on some cinnamon and sugar, rolled it back up. And this is like before it became the sticky bun, that was the only thing I did. And when I what came out of that, like I love sweets, but I don't think like things that are too sweet. Like that balance of sour and sweet is so so good to me. Mm-hmm. And so the result of that was delicious. And I gave one to a friend and she was just like, oh, my God, I've never had anything like this. And it wasn't even my best bread. It didn't rise super well because it was just experimental. But then I started to really experiment with it. And then the eventual result was like I started putting buttermilk powder in the dough and that added something new to the texture and the richness.
Yeah.
And putting a layer of gooey caramel pecan walnut deliciousness to make them sticky buns.
Dang.
And they became little masterpieces.
Ugh. So good.
So, yeah. So you all are talking about your favorite kinds of bread to make and what the sort of end product is, you know, what is your perfect bread? Tell me, you know, what were some of the mistakes that led you to your bread that you have today? So what was a bad cinnamon roll, sourdough cinnamon roll that you made?
Rushing it, basically, when feeling like I'm always trying to fit too many things into a 24-hour period. And, you know, working full time and wanting to bake all the time, too, for a bit. I definitely would rush it every now and then. Like, oh, the start, it's not quite there, but it'll get there. And it didn't get there. And yeah. So the product was like subpar, you know, not terrible, not inedible, but just like, and people are like, oh, but it's great. Like, I love it. And you're looking at it like, this is one of the worst things I've made. This is really depressing and disappointing.
Yeah.
So I'd say it's generally been time related. Those are the biggest mistakes that I make again and again, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what part did you time wrong?
A little bit of everything, but I would say more often than not, it's like the final rise that gets timed a little bit off. Like I just don't quite have enough time to let it rise to minimum double its dough baseline dough size, and I'm just going to go with it. Sort of deal.
Yeah. Mine's always probably been an underdeveloped starter. Mm. And I think that just came from like learning what a true starter that's ready looks and smells and feels like. So I think a lot of my breads were essentially unleavened. So
yeah.
That's why you would like, I'd pull it out of the oven and it was like, it weighed 10 pounds and it was just this like awful, sad brick that you could easily like break into a car window with. Mm-hmm.
I think definitely having seen somebody do it and handle it gave me an early start to know what it should look like. I didn't always follow that. And I took the risks of it not being there. But when you do see it, it's like, it should like, it as a body of liquid should be airy, just like full of air, and there should be a beautiful foam on top that, and just like it's like bubbling in front of your eyes alive when you go to use it. That's what is like perfect
starter. Yeah.
If it's started to develop a little bit of hooch, you're past the peak. If the so like that clear-ish liquid that's very, very stinky. Mm-hmm. And if it's doesn't have a foam.
Yeah, if there's no air bubbles.
If there's no air bubbles, definitely not ready.
That's why the quart jar is great because you can like see what's going on. And it's cool to just like that helps you learn to know your starter too and like see the cycles. Like I usually feed mine if I'm planning to bake on like a Sunday, I'll try to feed it at least by Saturday night. Mm-hmm. Ideally, if I can get two feedings in, like maybe Friday night, and then dump it out the next day a little bit and then feed it again, that gets it like really happy and bubbly, just because it's like that bacteria is working to break down all the stuff you just added. And so it creates that off-gassing, and that's where you're getting like the nice foamy bubbly starter. But if I feed it the night before, like you'll notice right when you mix it, it just looks like flour and water. It just looks like a little, like a really wet dough. And then usually by the next morning, like it's bubbled up. It's really foamy. It looks like a cross section of a sponge or like the cross section of our bread. Yeah. Like those little
similar to bubbles. Angie's bread here. You want to see bubbles at the bottom of your jar.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like one of the, if you've got foam on the top and bubbles at the bottom, it's ready.
It's doing. Yeah. And then you'll see it come down. So then like a couple, maybe 6 hours after that, depending again on like how hot your kitchen is, how cold. But you'll see it start to like come down from that high. Yeah. Like the bubbles go away and decompresses a little bit. And that's when it's like, well, it's not really as lively and you're not going to get as good of a spring to your bread.
So, Holly, you mentioned that once you get that hooch, you've already passed the peak. How do you recover your starter?
I mean, pour off the hooch, add a little fresh water and a little fresh flour.
You just feed it again.
That's it. Yeah, you feed it again, give it some time to regain that liveliness.
Yeah, the idea is just that you're using your starter to mix your dough when your starter is at like its peak of that little feeding cycle. Like it's started to eat the fresh water and flour and it's like reproducing and doing its thing. And then once it's kind of spent that out, it's okay to just like sit on your counter. You'll just have to feed it again before you use it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So just a few more questions. I've got some straightforward questions. Do you knead by hand or do you use a tool?
I knead by hand. I think the most labor intensive that I've done has been like when making multiple batches of bagels, which require tons of kneading. But kneading by hand is pretty nice. With sourdough, you really don't need to knead.
There's no need.
Ever to knead. Yeah, there's no need.
Yeah, I do both.
Pretty minimal.
I do the like super easy sandwich bread that I make. I throw that in my KitchenAid mixer, dump all the things and turn it on for 10 minutes and walk away. And then I put it into the bread pan, let it rise and bake it. And it's like, it's good. It's fine. For this like crustier loaf, this recipe especially is great. It's essentially a no knead. So you mix all your stuff, you put it into a like a big bowl. And then for like 4 hours, you do this sort of bulk fermentation. And every 30 minutes, I'll just like reach in and fold the bread over on itself in the bowl. And I do that like 3 or 4 times. And that's pretty much it. And then you kind of shape your loaves or whatever, but it's not like your traditional like, I have it on the counter. Yeah. And I feel like that was another area where I made a lot of mistakes was kneading. Like I would over knead it.
That's
and that
good,
would wreck the texture of the bread, or I wouldn't knead it enough. And so I've kind of leaned into the no knead method because it's pretty foolproof.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say the best breads have come from barely touching them, like as minimally as possible, just enough to like transfer them from one container to the next.
And you're saying with sourdough or with other breads too?
With sourdough.
Okay.
I think that generally speaking, because with sourdough, the yeast has done the work for you in creating these like nice long gluten strands in the bread. Like it's had the time to digest and create gluten. And whereas like in your typical store-bought, like active dry yeast bread, you are needing to like force that process.
Yeah, it's like pre-digested.
Which also
in the best way.
Also means that a lot of people who have gluten sensitivities can eat sourdough without having any issue because of that digestion process that has already occurred. There's a lot written about that, and you'll hear from people who can attest to it how like, I can totally eat sourdough, like true sourdough, and have no problem whatsoever. But my gut is wrecked if I have a non-sourdough bread.
Yeah. It's just that longer, slower, more complex process that happens while your dough is like developing and fermenting.
Yep.
Which is cool.
Okay. Yeah. Right on. Another, you know, simple question. Do you use oil or flour to knead when you need?
When there is a need.
I use some oil on my hands.
Do you? I've never used oil on my hands. I don't know. I've what a trick that I've learned that's been effective, especially with this one because this is a pretty wet dough, is just get your hands wet before you touch the bread. I mean, if you're kneading it on the counter, it's a little bit different because you're incorporating things into it and you're like working your hands. But for the no-knead bread where it's just in a big bowl and I'm essentially like picking up one corner, folding it over onto itself, picking up another, folding it, I just get my hands wet under the faucet and then the bread doesn't like stick to your hands and it's easy to deal with. But I'm not like working it for 10 minutes. It's a pretty quick
You definitely, the recipes that you're using are created with like that balance of water calculated in for you. So when you're going off from that, it's going to change your bread texture and everything. So if you're adding a lot of flour, you're likely going to end up with a drier bread. And versus like the oil, I don't find it really ever makes that much difference. I'm not adding globs of it. I'm just like a thin, just enough that my hands aren't sticking. And I use a silicone mat on my table when I am handling bread, and that also minimizes the sticking for those wetter runs.
Another fun fact that I learned from this bread book especially is to use rice flour.
Yes.
Not when you're like kneading necessarily or incorporating, but like if you let your bread rise in a bowl. Some people like to line the bowl with like a flour sack towel or just a really lightweight kitchen towel. And then when you, you know, flip it out after it's risen into your baking pan, it's easy. It makes it easy to release. It's pretty incredible. Like it, the bread doesn't stick to your towel or stick to your bowl. It's like a really nice.
Yeah, the rice flour. I do that as well. That was a Bon Appetit tip that I learned one time.
Hot tip.
And loved it.
Right on. Okay, cool. Well, I've really been enjoying our conversation.
Same.
Yeah.
This is fun.
Well, yeah.
Who doesn't like talking about bread?
I want to talk about bread, especially while you're eating it.
I know.
Well, thank you so much for bringing in the bread.
Yeah, of course. You're welcome.
It's been amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, are there any parting words you all have or you think we got to most of it?
I just would encourage people to try and experiment because it is really fun. And it's just another powerful thing to kind of have control of. Like once you realize it's pretty simple and it's you can create this like beautiful, delicious thing from essentially nothing like flour and water. Like that is a cool skill to have. And it's so easy. Like
it's once you get it
and just stick with it. Cause like I said, I struggled for years of really bad, bad loaves of bread, but I was like, I have to have my sourdough. So it's worth the effort and it's a fun process to learn too.
Yeah. I feel like too, like once you are comfortable using it, just applying it to practically everything just becomes a whole new funtivity.
Pizza dough, like your home-baked pizzas, once you master like how your dough works and once you're kind of comfortable with it, like, yeah, you can make the best pizza at home.
You can change other recipes that were your favorite pre-sourdough to become sourdough recipes too, and it's pretty easy switch to make. And there's so many helpful online things about it. Man, with the web at your fingertips, like there's so everybody's done it before you. And so like YouTube it if you're someone who needs to like see someone doing it themselves or like, you know, we've been talking about what the sourdough starter would look like or feel like, but it really does help to like see for yourself. And YouTube is the next best to that live demo.
But I would too, another plug, like the Tartine bread book is great. They have a ton of photos of like every step of the process, which is nice, like next to a video. It's a super helpful, easy to understand guide. And then the other book that I think you turned me on to is The Wild Bread.
Wild Bread is
and that's
so good.
Less imagery, a lot of words, but she walks you through like everything about what, like if you want to understand this bread science and like what you're dealing with, it's very informative and it's a great book
too. I would say the other one I have that I go to all the time is The Bread Bible by Rose Levy Barenbaum. She's like an icon in the bread world. And that book definitely also doesn't have as many, it has a lot of beautiful photos of the end product, but not the step-by-step. But hers, like she definitely broke down the science of like that, the percentage of like water to flour to enriching ingredients like your butter or your milk or your oil. And like, if you follow her recipe, you will have a beautiful bread. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And eat bread. That's the last thing. Eat lots of bread. It's delicious.
Okay. Well, you guys rock. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, June.
Thank you, June, for having us.
Absolutely. These are some of my favorite Talk on the Rocks is when we've got two people in the studio. That always makes it better. And when we're just talking about, you know, a process that you guys have figured out and, you know, you all have figured out together in some ways, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely talk on a regular basis about our little things that we've learned.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
For sure. Yeah, Wrangle Bread Club.
Bread Club. Okay. The time is 1:47. You have been listening to Talk on the Rock. And as always, we will be back next week with another guest. See you then.